pain. A lot of people do, though.
No, no.
Sometimes the emails come in.
You're taking your role seriously. And that's, I forgot you had that. Yeah. No, because Betts is a friend of mine.
Sure.
The sun is and is going. If you can do something about the tiles tomorrow on the roof, do that already.
No, I have to get it.
Is this screen blocking the sun for you at home?
Actually, the sun's over there.
Okay.
So I'm sitting, I'm using the pillar here to protect my eyes. It can't make it through the concrete, yeah.
Right.
We've been here before.
Yes. Yeah. You want a water, Mayor? Hey, how are you, man?
Good to see you, my friend.
Good to see you.
I wonder if I close this, is it going to put it to sleep?
Probably.
Okay, I'll just be more careful with my notes then. How's that? Are we ready to go? Okay. Hello, everyone. Is my mic on? Can you all hear me?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. We're very glad to have you here as we celebrate this exhibit. I'm Karen Williams. I'm the Dean of Libraries, and it's my distinct pleasure to welcome you tonight and to tell you just how exciting I think this exhibit is that's celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act. I'm going to apologize to those of you who may not have the sun blocked. We've got various things here blocking the sun coming in these windows. It's just that perfect time of day when the sun is a little bit in our eyes. I see it in your eyes, too. So, sorry about that. So if people want to slide one way or the other, I'll be fine with that if you can find a better chair for yourself. And then hopefully in just a few minutes, the sun will go down low enough that it won't be in anybody's eyes. So I think it's particularly fitting that the Wilderness Act be celebrated here in our community because of the high value that Arizona and Tucson in particular place on wilderness areas. I've learned a whole lot about this exhibit through this exhibit, sorry, that Tucson is literally surrounded by wilderness areas. So we have the Push Ridge Wilderness Area to the north. East of us, the wilderness areas of Saguaro National Park. Also to the east, the Rincon Mountain Wilderness Area. And then, of course, to our south, we have the Mount Wrightson Wilderness Area. And as a former backpacker, I have a very deep and personal appreciation for wilderness areas. They offer so much. They offer us beauty, they offer us serenity, they offer us excitement. I'm reminded of one of our backpacking trips when we headed off into the Mazatzal Wilderness Area, which is north of here. I was with seven of my closest friends, so there were eight of us and two dogs on this trip. We got halfway through our day and lost track of each other, got split into two groups, and we actually spent the night apart, camping in two different places in the wilderness area until we finally found each other again the next day. It was quite the story and quite a lot of fun that we had in the wilderness area. But my back has now betrayed me, so my backpacking days are over, and these days I'm just hiking and doing some river rafting and continuing to enjoy the wilderness areas that way. So you may or may not know that Arizona has a total of 90 wilderness areas, and in that we are second only to the state of California. And these 90 areas comprise 4.5 million acres. Arizona is also one of only five states that has wilderness areas managed by all of our four federal wilderness management organizations. And in case you're wondering, those include the Bureau of Land Management, Fish and Wildlife Service, the Forest Service, and the National Park Service. So given the importance of wilderness to our community, it's especially appropriate that Pima County, the City of Tucson, and the town of Oro Valley have all passed proclamations designating September as Celebrate Wilderness Month in their respective jurisdictions. These proclamations recognize the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, as well as the importance of designated wilderness to our community. I'd like to recognize representatives from these jurisdictions who are with us this evening. We have with us Supervisor Richard Elias from the Pima County Board of Supervisors, and we have Tucson Mayor Jonathan Rothschild, and I think we have Tucson Vice Mayor here. Is he Steve Kosicek? Is he here tonight?
Not arrived yet.
Not arrived yet. Okay, he will be arriving. And right now, Supervisor Elias and Mayor Rothschild are going to come up here, and they're going to say a few words to us.
I'm going to go first here tonight, and I'll read the proclamation. Our proclamations are similar, and Richard and I do this a lot, and so we'll flip for who reads the proclamation and who gives a speech. And tonight I asked if Richard would make this speech because I want to hear him talk on this subject. Richard is passionate about wilderness. He's passionate about the values of wilderness. But before I read the proclamation, I'd like to speak to something just a little different, and that is the importance of our special collections and the importance of our gathering the artifacts. This special collection, you will go out, and if you look at it, it's really about three men who are at the heart of Southern Arizona history. Edward Abbey, the author, and two brothers, Stuart Udall and Morris Udall. And Stuart Udall, at the time of the passage of the Wilderness Act, was the Secretary of the Interior 50 years ago, and Morris Udall, his brother, was a congressperson. And I can remember as a very, very young child having my father take me to Stuart Udall's office in Washington, D.C. when he was the Secretary of the Interior. It was a beautiful office with Native American rugs and Remington sculptures. It was like a museum. And the story I remember is him telling, my dad was in awe, and he said, God, it must be great to be this close to the president, and you just go in to see the president, and the president makes decisions and does things. And Stuart said, Lowell's my dad's name, is Lowell, he says, the president can say whatever he wants, but those dang administrators just do what they want. And now that I'm the mayor, I kind of know the feeling. With that, let me read the proclamation that is representative of both the city, the county, the Oro Valley, and I believe all the jurisdictions. Whereas the United States Congress passed the Wilderness Act by a bipartisan vote, and this far-sighted legislation was signed by President Lyndon Johnson on September 3rd, 1964. And whereas the Wilderness Act brought into being America's National Wilderness Preservation System, federal lands to be administered for the use and enjoyment of the American people in such manner as will leave them unimpaired for future use and enjoyment as wilderness, and will provide for the protection of these areas and the preservation of their wilderness character. And this language is very important. I'll try to read it slow enough so you can really soak it in. Whereas the Wilderness Act made it the, quote, policy of the Congress to secure for the American people of present and future generations the benefits of an enduring resource of wilderness in order to assure that an increasing population, accompanied by expanding settlement and growing mechanization, does not occupy and modify all areas within the United States and its possessions, leaving no lands designated for preservation and protection in their natural condition. And whereas wilderness, quote, in contrast with those areas where man and his own works dominate the landscape, is recognized as federal land retaining its primeval character and influence, which generally appears to have been affected primarily by the forces of nature, with the imprint of man's work substantially unnoticeable, and has outstanding opportunities for solitude or a primitive and unconfined type of recreation. If Congress could just write like that today, I would. Whereas Tucson's wilderness areas are Push Ridge Wilderness, Saguaro Wilderness, Rincon Mountain Wilderness, Coyote Mountain Wilderness, Babokivari Peak Wilderness, Redfield Canyon Wilderness, Galeuro Wilderness, and Mount Reitstein Wilderness, and these wilderness areas are important to the citizens of Tucson for their recreational opportunities, clean air, clean water, groundwater recharge, and diverse and abundant wildlife. Therefore, I, Jonathan Rothschild, Mayor of the City of Tucson, apparently along with Mayor Satish Haramai of the Boro Valley and Supervisor Richard Elias of Pima County, all do proclaim September 2014 to be Wilderness Month in this community and encourage all of our citizens to celebrate the Wilderness Act, to let people know the history of the Wilderness Act, and to let people know of the importance of our wilderness today and into the future. In witness whereof, I have set my hand and caused the seal of the City of Tucson to be affixed this 26th day of August, 2014, signed by Jonathan Rothschild, Mayor of the City of Tucson. So for all of you, Wilderness Month, September 2014. And with that, I bring on the main act, County Supervisor Richard Elias.
We got all these proclamations here, so we can put them over there. Some more artifacts for those special collections librarians. Wilderness. Wilderness areas surrounding us here are so important, key to protecting and being good stewards of the place that we live. The Lower Sonoran Desert, very special place, and we're surrounded by all these wilderness areas and these beautiful sky islands that we try and protect and we work so hard at. And we're going to continue to do that through a variety of different means, but certainly the Wilderness Act has been one of the prime enablers for us to be able to protect really important biological places. You know, the heart of Tucson is there with that whole notion of conservation. The Sonoran Desert Conservation Plan was a small part of that. The creation of Tucson Mountain Park, arguably the most profound decision ever made by the Pima County Board of Supervisors, was about conservation. Absolutely. And many years have passed since all of those things have been put into place, and we still struggle to protect our wilderness areas. We still try and struggle to protect those pristine places. We still try and struggle to protect our national forests. Shook, Babad, the Tucson Mountains, Black Mountains. You know, Babad Doag, the Catalina, Santa Catalina Mountains, Frog Mountain. And then down south, the Chu Doag. Those are the autumn names for those ranges. tried to find the one for Rincon's, but I know it's Turkey Neck Mountain, but I couldn't find the exact words, and so I didn't want to put out what I thought was probably wrong information, because I did see it a couple places. Chuck Bowden just died this weekend. His description of those places, those wilderness areas included, Bush Ridge, Sahuatl, Rincon, Mount Wrightson. He had a wonderful way of intertwining nature and those humans that inhabit this place. And looking at some of the darker sides of all of that, Chuck found a very good way to describe what we have here in Southern Arizona. We should be thankful that he wrote many books about those subjects and intertwined those subjects, so we had a good understanding of why it's important, so important to be good stewards of the Sonoran Desert and where we live. There's no way we can underestimate the value of that and what it's taught all of us to. That's going to go on, educating ourselves about this place and the struggles to protect. These Sky Islands are going to continue because they're rich. And they're filled with minerals, and they're filled with important resources that come into question and bring about very difficult issues for all of us to resolve. We're in the midst of that right now with the Santa Rita Mountains. We're going to continue to work to be good stewards of this place. I think that's important. And as we celebrate the Wilderness Act, those of us who believe in those values should stand up and let that be known, because it's important, maybe now more than ever. And so I thank you all for doing this. I thank the U of A Special Collections Library, because you guys do these great community events, and you bring folks out to have a better understanding of the place we live. And Bob Diaz, you know, did a good job in several other of these kind of events that we've had here at Special Collections. I enjoy them. I appreciate them. Thank you all for coming out and giving us a few minutes to talk, and welcome you all here to our home at the University of Arizona. Thank you.
I want to say thanks to both Mayor Rothschild and Supervisor Elias for calling out the work that we do here in Special Collections. And I say that because I'm taking credit on behalf of my colleagues who actually do all the wonderful events and exhibits that we have here. What we have in the collections here is truly amazing. The special collections are those things that are either very rare or completely and totally unique. They're wonderful treasures that we offer to the community, and we like nothing better than when we can do something that either has us partnering with the community or showcasing materials that are important to the community in some way. And as you said, we've had a number of opportunities to do that, and we want to continue those opportunities. So I'll throw out an invitation to all of you out there. If you know, happen to know about where we have some really rich and deep collections that are important to the community for, in one way or another, we would love to partner on that over the next few years. And we have often guest curators. We have a guest curator who worked with Bob Diaz on this one today. So we've got those opportunities out there, and we invite you to share your ideas with us. And now I'm going to go back on script. I get a script so that I don't wander too far off introducing folks. I will say, though, I'm feeling just a tad bit guilty that we do have a number of you sitting in the sun. I can see with this going on over here. So I am wondering a little bit if there's some way that we could slide this screen a little bit this way to block some of the sun, or is that not going to help, Angus? Do you think if we try that? He'll give it a shot. Okay. Or there are a couple of seats up in the front row here for reserved, and we could slide chairs that way. I'm just feeling terrible about those of you in the first few rows on this side of the room who are wearing your sunglasses to look at me. Slide this one too? Okay. We'll see if we can do a few adjustments while I finish the acknowledgments, and thank you for your patience with us. So, for his help in curating the exhibit, I want to thank Kevin Dahl. And Kevin, I met when I came in. Where is he? That made it worse? It just moved it. Sorry. Move that one back and bring this one over. I want you all to be able to appreciate Kevin, so wave again. There he is in the back. Kevin is the program manager of the Tucson Field Office of the National Parks Conservation Association. Also, in addition to Kevin, I want to recognize Jared Mingus, who's one of our exceptional student workers. Is Jared here tonight? There he is. Thank you. These folks were a big help to the co-creators for this exhibit, or the co-curators, excuse me, Bob Diaz, and Bob is in the front row here, and he's our exhibition specialist. And then his cohort here was Meg Wiesner, and I'll tell you more about Meg in a minute. I also would be remiss if I didn't extend appreciation to the Friends of the Library who helped to underwrite these community events. So, to tell you more about the Wilderness Act and how Arizonans have been influential in the wilderness movement, I'd like to introduce Meg Wiesner. We're very fortunate to have Meg co-curate the exhibit, and without her knowledge and hard work, the exhibit would not be nearly this strong. Meg is retired following a 34-year career with the National Park Service. She spent the last 20 years as Chief of Science and Resources Management at Saguaro National Park. Early last year, she volunteered to lead the Sierra Club's efforts to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act in Arizona, and she's worked on a variety of projects in that role. And I know that a number of you out there have also been very active with the Sierra Club in working on this. So thank you for those efforts. Meg has a journalism degree from the Medill School at Northwestern University and a master's in wildland recreation management from the University of Ohio. She's a true adventurer, has visited all 50 states, and almost, get this, 300 units of the national park system. So please join me in welcoming Meg.
Thank you very much, and thanks to the mayor and and to Supervisor Elias for your remarks as well. That was truly inspiring, and if I talk long enough, the sun will go down and nobody will have to put everything in front of their heads anymore. I'm going to talk tonight briefly about the Wilderness Act. I'll start with the history and designation of wilderness areas, talk a little bit about stewardship of wilderness, and then move on into some of the benefits of wilderness and how we're celebrating this year. Tomorrow is the actual date of the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Wilderness Act, so I thought it was really appropriate that we're able to do this opening event tonight on the eve of the actual anniversary. Now, because wilderness is in places all the way from Florida to Hawaii to Alaska, no one date was suitable for everyone to celebrate the Wilderness Act. So it was determined early on that we would celebrate for the entire year of 2014. So no matter where you are, the weather will be good somewhere during the year so that you can celebrate your local wilderness areas. So with that, I'll go ahead. You know, when you think of the name wilderness, so I probably first heard that word from the Bible. It's where Jesus went for inspiration. But I'm not going to talk about that today. I'm going to talk about North America and our experience with wilderness. So sort of the conventional wisdom goes that, you know, the land was wilderness and Europeans came here. Well, we now know that it wasn't really unoccupied. There were 500 different nations, and many of them had influence on the landscape. But nonetheless, it was in a much less modified condition than what we see now. So we'll go back to the first 200 years, 1500 to 1700. I'll go through these years really quickly. But this is a period where explorers were just starting to come in on the edges of the continent. And for them, wilderness, the country that they were entering, was they considered it really wild and rather hostile. And their goal was to conquer it and civilize it. It didn't change too much in the next 100 years, between 1700 and 1800. When the fur trappers and the Daniel Boones and folks, you know, went a little further into the wilderness and ventured into the inside, into the middle of the continent, and still had the idea of this was kind of a hostile place and they wanted to change it. We'll skip to the next 100 years. Things start to change then. Early in the 1800s was the Louisiana Purchase, doubled the size of our nation, and President Jefferson sent Lewis and Clark out to see what it was that he bought from the French. And they found a lot of native peoples out there and how they used the landscape. And there were people who proposed saving a place for that community just as it was. Meanwhile, back in Europe, William Wordsworth, you might remember him from English class in high school, he was the first nature poet. Prior to that, poetry was things like Shakespeare's sonnets. It was about love. It was about religion. Nobody wrote about nature. And all of a sudden, William Wordsworth, and this is a picture I took last summer when I was able to visit the Lake District in England where he lived, and that's Dove Cottage where he wrote many of his works. He wrote about daffodils and about nature and the beautiful mountains. And Thoreau, in this country, and Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, were similarly. I mean, Thoreau decided he wanted to go live in Walden Pond for a year. You know, and that was very anti-civilizing. So all of a sudden you see a starting of the appreciation of nature. It also occurred in art. Here's a picture that I took again from the Lake District, which is a glaciated area up in the northwest corner of England. And there were artists in England, and that came back over the pond to the United States as the Hudson River School in the early 1800s. And an appreciation of nature. Now, if you go to an art museum, you'll see that prior to this time, most artworks were religious, or they were about people. Think Rembrandt or Bruegel, the communities in I'm not sure if it was Belgium or Holland where he was. But no one had painted nature until about the 1800s. So there was an increasing appreciation for nature in its own sake and its beauty. But meanwhile, here in the United States, we're sending folks down the Oregon Trail out to conquer the western states, and there's still that mentality. So there's sort of a dichotomy between starting to appreciate nature in its natural condition and then also still trying to conquer it and find ways to settle it and live there. The 49ers got to California, discovered gold, and were civilizing San Francisco and those places. But they also discovered Yosemite Valley and found it beautiful and worthy of protection. So the first, in 1864, right in the middle of the Civil War, the Congress gave the Yosemite grant to the state of California to manage it as a state park in a protected condition. So it's actually celebrating its 150th anniversary this year. It later became a national park. But a few years later, 1872, was the first national park recognized by our Congress. So again, starting with the Wordsworth Thoreau tradition of starting to appreciate nature, you all of a sudden start to get some areas set aside. Okay, so we're about up to 1900 now, and so we'll go through the first half of the 20th century. Now, let me go back a little bit if I can. Oops, that's not easy to do. There you go. Okay, the Forest Service, the first forest reserves were set aside by Theodore Roosevelt in the early 1900s. The Forest Service was established, the National Park Service was established, and the Antiquities Act was passed, which allowed the president to set aside national monuments. Arizona, we have a lot of fairly new national monuments that were set aside by President Bill Clinton. We have some of the older ones too. Grand Canyon National Park was first protected as a national monument because Congress wasn't acting on it, and the president set that aside. And then along in about 1924, the first wilderness area was set aside, the Gila Wilderness, just over the border in New Mexico. And I've often sort of thought, well, why wilderness? They had all these other things, but then all of a sudden it was wilderness. Well, that goes back to this, cars and roads. So prior to the, you know, everybody wanting to get a, Henry Ford and the Model T and everybody getting one, people didn't need cars. They had horses and buggies. The people in the cities didn't need cars because they had public transportation to get to work. And the cars, you didn't need the car to get to work. You needed the car to get out of the city and into nature. And there was a huge effort in the 20s to build roads everywhere so that everybody could take their Model T or equivalent car out into the wilderness everywhere. And there were a few people who were really worried that everything was going to become paved, even in the 20s. Even the National Park Service was building roads through all of its parks so that people could see them in their cars. And the Forest Service was building roads to remote lakes and leasing out cabin sites at that time. A famous guy named Aldo Leopold, you might have heard of him. He was one of the first people who came up with the idea, and it was around Lake Mary up near Flagstaff. He worked in that area, and he was supposed to line out some lots and for cabin leases up there, and he decided, you know, these really shouldn't be cabin leases. This lake should have access to the public all the time. It should be protected so that the public can enjoy this instead of just a few people who are going to be leasing the cabins. That idea spread, and eventually he started working over in New Mexico, and he's the one who proposed the Gila Wilderness. The Forest Service went on to do various other wilderness areas, but you know what? Some of those wilderness areas that they had set aside administratively, they decided that there was a nice place they wanted to put a road later, or they decided they needed to harvest a little timber over here, and they kept cutting areas out of those wilderness designations. So the Wilderness Society was established in 1935. Aldo Leopold was one of the 8 founding members of the Wilderness Society. And they said, you know, we need a law that sets wilderness aside forever. It's not enough just to have the agency administrative designations. There needs to be a law. And that's what the Wilderness Society was all about. They had a few partners in other conservation organizations as well, but too numerous for me to mention here. So now we're up to about 1950. That's the start of political activism, a lot of civil rights movements, but the environmental movement came right alongside that. And here's a guy, some of you may have seen a picture of him before. He was Howard Zonizer. He was executive director of the Wilderness Society, and he's the one who really shepherded through the Wilderness Act. It was first introduced in Congress in 1956. Over the next 8 years, they had 18 public hearings, both in D.C. and around the nation. There were introduced 65 versions of the Wilderness Act. In the end, by 1964, it passed unanimously in both Congresses. So we heard some language that was in the proclamations that Mayor Rothschild read. Some of the most poetic language ever in a bill passed by Congress. I just love it. So thanks for reading that. Anyway, Howard Zonizer was, people say he was sort of a sideline poet in his own right, and he wrote most of that language that we can read and enjoy today. So it's through his dedication that in 8 years of really hard work that he got every single member of Congress and the Senate to vote yes on the final version of the Wilderness Act. But key in that was our own favorite son from Arizona, Stuart Udall. He was Secretary of the Interior from 1961 to 1968, and he had an important part in this because he knew that some of the areas that he managed, all the fish and wildlife refuges and all the national parks, would be subject to evaluation for potential wilderness areas. The Bureau of Land Management lands were added later. So, again, September 3rd, 1964, 50 years ago tomorrow, here's a gathering in the Rose Garden as President Johnson signs the Wilderness Bill. He's already signed it here, and over on the right of your screen here is Stuart Udall, kind of looking over his shoulder, probably introducing the two ladies to whom he's giving the pins. This one is Howard Zonizer's widow. He died just a few months before the final version was passed. And this is Marty Murray, who is the widow of Olus Murray, and the two of them both were from Alaska, and they were very strong wilderness advocates. A copy of one of the pins, and you'll be pleased to know, if you look on the walls outside, there's one of those pins and a different kind, slightly different picture depicting the signing of the Wilderness Act. So what does it say? You heard some of the language before, so I won't stay on this very long, but it's undeveloped federal land. It doesn't have anything to do with state lands or private lands or Indian Nation lands. It's federal land, retains its primeval character and influence without permanent improvement or human habitation. There's a further definition that says it appears to have been affected primarily by the forces of nature, with the imprint of man's work substantially unnoticeable. That's an important phrase. It has been controversial over the time because some people think wilderness areas to be designated should be absolutely pure, no evidence of humans being there whatsoever. But in the long run, as they go back and they really look at the language in the Wilderness Act, it says man's work substantially unnoticeable. And there's also the idea that areas that had been disturbed, particularly in the eastern United States, a lot of areas had been logged or farmed or whatever, but those can recover and become wilderness areas. So it was actually an important philosophical point that they, you could have lands that might not be exactly pristine, but they had potential and therefore could be added to the National Wilderness Preservation System. A couple more quotes from the Wilderness Act. The areas have outstanding opportunities for solitude and a primitive and unconfined type of recreation. And finally, they can also contain ecological, geological, or other features of scientific, educational, scenic, or historical value. Early on, a lot of the managers went and got rid of all historic cabins in wilderness areas once they'd been designated, because they thought that was an evidence of man that was not compatible. And a little later, I think managers now are a little better informed that the items of historical value are written right into the act, that it's okay. It's okay to have science, it's okay to have historical value there. And it is a balancing act with the managers. There's lots of, for them to think about and lots to do. Okay, the Wilderness Act made 54 immediate wilderness areas. These are the areas that the Forest Service had evaluated and given the term wilderness, as opposed to a primitive area or a wild area. And then all those agencies were asked to study all of their roadless lands and decide if there were any that would make additional wilderness areas, which ones were suitable, and propose them for congressional action. Now, just to give you an idea of the magnitude of that, these were 54 original wilderness areas, and this is a picture of the Selway-Bitterroot in Idaho, which was the largest of those original wilderness areas. Here in Arizona, we had 5 original wilderness areas, and the Chiricahuas and the Superstition Mountains are 2 of those original 5. But it took just a matter, well, now there are more than 700 wilderness areas covering in 44 different states plus Puerto Rico. So it's really widespread. It took a lot of people, a lot of dedicated citizens. Some of them are in this room. All of you in this room could be among those dedicated citizens who advocate for wilderness areas. Edward Abbey was one of those people. Again, he was born back east, but he ended up making his home in southern Arizona and in the Oracle area. He wrote Desert Solitaire. It was published in 1969, and it influenced people of my generation, including me. The subtitle of his book is A Season in the Wilderness, and it's about him being a seasonal ranger in Arches, what's now Arches National Park. It was a national monument at that time. And he talks about how great it is to actually get out and experience the desert area instead of just looking at it through the windows of your air-conditioned car. His language is a little spicy and salty every now and then, but kind of a fun read. You'll see a cabinet out in the other room that has a couple dozen books that he's written. He was quite a prolific author. But Desert Solitaire really turned a lot of people into that wilderness campaign when the agencies were reviewing all of their roadless areas and trying to decide which ones were appropriate for wilderness. Another key person in that, particularly in Arizona, was Morris K. Udall. He was the congressman representing our area. He served in Congress from 1961 to 1991 when he retired because of health reasons. He introduced all of the Arizona wilderness bills, and some of the big ones in particular, he really worked hard to and got them through Congress and passed. That's why Arizona has 90 wilderness areas, second only to California. So let me give you just a little bit of the quick history of Arizona wilderness. There were various laws passed through the 1970s. Petrified National Forest was among the first wilderness areas in the National Park Service in 1976, so our national park had its wilderness designated. In 78, the Push Ridge Wilderness was designated. These were like individual wilderness areas that were ready to go and were passed into law. But the big bills came a little later. 1984 was the Arizona Wilderness Act. By this time, the Forest Service had studied all of their roadless lands, and in cooperation with organizations here in Arizona, like the Sierra Club, representatives from the Wilderness Society, the Arizona Wilderness Coalition, pushed and got the 1984 bill passed, which is pretty much most of the Forest Service wilderness areas are included in that bill, as well as some of the very early Bureau of Land Management wildernesses. That includes areas like Aravaipa Canyon and the Vermilion Cliffs Perea Creek Wilderness Area. 6 years later, the Arizona Desert Wilderness Act was passed. It included the rest of the BLM areas, which is 40-some areas, as well as 4 National Wildlife Refuges that have wilderness. That includes the Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge, which is the largest wilderness area in Arizona. So in total, in Arizona, we have 90 wilderness areas. If you were to visit 2 a week, it would take you almost a year to get to all of them, and 4.5 million acres. So that brings us up to the year 2000, not too long ago. There's been less going on with wilderness since the year 2000. It might be the politics of our country, other things have become important, it's hard to say. But we have had, in 2009, a comprehensive land management bill was passed, included several wilderness areas. And this is the Owyhee Canyons in Idaho. And when I first put this presentation together, this was the slide that represented the last action on wilderness in 2009. But in March of this year, I think it was March, we had one more wilderness area designated. Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore in Wisconsin had its wilderness designated. And so I had to add this extra slide. In all, since the Wilderness Act was passed in 1964, every president has signed new areas into wilderness, every single one. Even ones that you wouldn't think would be terribly supportive of that. All the Congresses, except for the one just prior to the one that's in office right now, have passed additions to the National Wilderness Preservation System. So it's a pretty broad and widespread land designation. Okay, enough about the designations. Quickly go into the stewardship. You might say, well, what is the whole picture of the Wilderness Act? So these are wilderness areas by agency. Notice that more than half of all the wilderness areas are managed by the Forest Service. The Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Park Service have kind of small pieces of the pie. Now the next picture I'm going to show shows the acres, rather than the number of areas, it shows the acres. And it changes quite a bit. So on this slide, the National Park Service has 40%. So they don't have a lot of areas, but the areas they have are big. I will say a lot of them are in Alaska. And the same for the Fish and Wildlife Service. A lot of their areas are in Alaska. The Forest Service still has a pretty good chunk. The BLM has quite a few wilderness areas, but they tend to be kind of small. So how do you manage wilderness? There's no roads there. You can't fly a helicopter there. You can't ride your mountain bike or a motorcycle there. Well, agencies hire wilderness stewards, usually young rangers, to walk and manage the area. Contact people who are visiting the area, monitor to see what the conditions are. And I will say these stewards are assisted by many volunteers, mostly through conservation organizations, who go out and help the agencies with the eyes on the ground to see what's going on in the wilderness areas. Not all the wilderness areas are on land, so you have a possibility of boat patrols as well, the wilderness areas. And when you go to manage them, there's no chainsaws can be used there. If you've got a big log that falls across the trail and you want to get rid of it and clear the trail, use an old crosscut saw. There's another person on the other end of that saw. And with a good sharp saw and well-trained people, it doesn't really take that long to get through a log. The methods of traveling in wilderness are hiking, backpacking, and horsepacking, and you'll see some exhibit cases out there that have examples of those activities. What are the benefits of wilderness? Now, this is one that has a lot of pictures and sort of a few words, and I sort of like to run through it without taking the time to read all the words, so I'll let you guys do that while you enjoy the pictures of a variety of different kind of wildernesses. Unfortunately, I can't really say where all of them are. America was the first country in the world to pass wilderness legislation. There's about 20, 25 countries that have passed similar legislation now or manage areas administratively as protected as wilderness areas, but it really is made in America. So a little bit about the celebration. I told you earlier that it was going on all year long. There are three goals that the group that's organizing this, and it's a group of 30 different organizations, including federal employees and a lot of different nonprofits and schools, and like the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts and various different kinds of organizations have been working on this celebration for about 3 years to increase awareness of wilderness, especially among non-traditional populations, to engage the youth, our future wilderness managers, wilderness stewards, and to work together with other wilderness organizations. National events, there's a website, www.wilderness50th.org, where all the activities and events that are going on for the Wilderness Anniversary are listed. Opening tomorrow at the Smithsonian Institute are 60 wonderful photographs, the winners of a photo contest that they held last year, all of wilderness areas. If you're in Washington in the next, I think it's 6 or 8 months, that it's going to be on display at the Museum of Natural History at the Smithsonian, so stop by and see that. And finally, the National Wilderness Conference, Albuquerque, New Mexico, won the bid to host that, and that'll be next month in October. Here in Arizona, we've been doing a whole lot of things all year long, but I decided to highlight a few things that are still coming up. Again, we have a wilderness that's just for Arizona. That's azwild50th.org. The Arizona Highway September issue, if you subscribe to that, has a little section on wilderness. There's this exhibit at the Special Collections, I put that in there. And the Wild for Wilderness Festival, which will be at Sabino Canyon. So there's a few other events that were just too numerous to list here, but you can check it out on that website. That's it. Hope you thank you for coming, and I hope you have time to see the exhibit as you they're leaving. I want to say also, I've got a few handouts over there, including one of these stickers with the Wilderness Anniversary logo. Help yourself to one of those. Put it on your own water bottle or whatever you want.
Are you willing to take questions if there are
sure.
any? Okay. So Meg has said she has some time to take questions. If any of you have them, you want to just direct them her way, and we'll do a little bit of question and answer before we move on. Can't hear me.
Back in the back.
Questions.
The question was to speak on the tribal perspectives on the Wilderness Act, and I don't know much about that. I'd like to know more. I'm currently reading a book that's called Thinking Like a Watershed that has some of that, and I believe there's going to be a presentation here in Tucson in late October. Is it the 25th, Barbara? Yep. That speaks just to that. I believe it's at the Historic Y, October 25th, so give a little plug for that. The Arizona Wilderness Coalition and the Arizona Humanities Council provided funding for that. Yes?
Mark Troutwine, who worked for Mo Udall, had a story in the Arizona Republic Sunday about the passing of the act, and perhaps if you haven't seen it, it might be useful.
Great. I hope I didn't misspeak at all then. He probably knows more about it than I do. Thank you for that. If anybody didn't hear that, there was an article in Sunday's Arizona Republic, right? Okay. Any other questions? Well, hearing none, thank you all for coming, and celebrate wilderness.
Very good. It's very
thank
nice,
so
Meg.
Thank you.
That was a great presentation.
Thank you very much.
You did. Very good.
We did it.
Very good.
You did it. You did it. It was a great presentation.
Oh, I had some help. Yeah, we'll get together. I had to add it.
I can explain why we didn't get here, but that's a really great presentation. Really high quality. It was a download from the website.
Oh, great!
But I modified it. You know, about half the slides have been modified by now. Well, and I love the kind of values. That's just such a nice.
This time of year,
it's such a really I did think about that. If you're in the wilderness, yeah, you can do whatever.
So did Keith show up for a long time?
Well, since I was told that I was an 8 years
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. some of these ended up just being blank. I didn't grab them all. As well as these.
Are they going first?
Doesn't matter. Big one here is
up to your time.
There. The smaller or the big one?
Yeah. these big chairs, just all like up against the wall.
Okay.
And we'll just scoot it with these steps on it and we'll just put them over there. So it's so
soon I'll come back.
These aren't easy to move that.
Just different.
This is the house that built it. Those pictures were taken in 1990, May of 1990.
She basically doing it.
It wasn't. We were.
Are you a grad student? All this great work?
I'm not a grad student, but I did help with this instead of
weekend
parties in the 70s. So this is why I thought you were talking now.
She's calling Scotty because he gets on the plane in half an hour.